May it please the court, this is a $3.5 million plaintiff's summary judgment that must be reversed. Fundamentally, there's multiple reasons for that, but fundamentally, the damage number in this case is not substantiated by legally competent evidence. As this court is well aware, any statement that is conclusory and has no support to back it up is considered no evidence. Even if it's uncontroverted, a conclusory statement is no evidence, whether it's made by a fact witness, whether it's made by an expert witness. The Texas Supreme Court holds time and again, conclusory testimony is no evidence. This court would have to set aside all of that precedent to determine that under this record, there is legally sufficient evidence to support $3.5 million in damages.
Are you asking this court, however, to reverse the summary judgment, but only as to the damages aspect of the summary judgment order? Or are you asking us to reverse both the, what I would consider the liability and the damages aspect?
We have four appellants in this case. We have Sunray Marketing, Sunray Terminal, Jane Helm individually, and Jeff Kirby individually. As to Terminal, Kirby, and Helm, all of them have disputed liability from the beginning to the end under the applicable rules, because they have also challenged liability on all the causes of action alleged against them. And we're also showing that there's no evidence to support a summary judgment on damages. The whole thing has to be reversed as to them.
Are you contesting the liability portion to Kirby and Hill based on the standing of their corporation status? Is that
not only that, but also, let's step back for a minute. PetroSource, being the movement for summary judgment, was required to conclusively establish its right to judgment. We have attacked their motion for summary judgment, contending that it was insufficient as a matter of law. In other words, we're saying the motion failed on submission. What we're saying is, if you look at Petro's motion and the evidence that's attached, you can see that Petro failed to conclusively prove its entitlement to a judgment in its favor. Okay. There's multiple reasons for that.
All right, but I am trying to, you represent four different parties. They all have different hats that they're wearing, so there are different technically causes of actions as to each one that the plaintiff must prove to each of the four parties.
Correct.
What I'm trying to ascertain is, and you could be just attacking the whole order to all four, or is there any part of it that you think that order is correct and you're not contesting?
The only part of it that I have to say to be true to the record is as to Sunray Marketing, they did not say below that they could not be held responsible for breach of contract. Everybody else said King's X, we're not responsible for this. Yes, correct. The individuals cannot be held liable in their individual capacities. The evidence, the pleadings, everything consistently says that Jane Helm and Jeff Kirby are simply members of limited liability companies. That's it. These people are jointly and severally liable for a $3.5 million judgment, yet they are only managers and members of limited liability companies. They should not be included in this lawsuit, let alone included in this judgment. And then Sunray Terminal was just the company that owns the tank. There is no evidence that Sunray Terminal took any action in this case with respect to this alleged movement of oil that was held under a bailment agreement.
Didn't Sunray Marketing admit to the selling of the crude?
Sunray Marketing's, here's the evidence in the summary judgment record attached to Petro's motion. There is testimony from Jeff Kirby, who is the manager of Sunray Marketing LLC and Terminal LLC, who says, we had consent to move the oil. They do admit to moving the oil, but Mr. Kirby testifies over and over and over again in the testimony attached to Petro's motion that David Kehoe, who is the principal, the manager of PetroSource, the plaintiff, knew it the whole time, consented to it, was well aware of it. As you can see from the...
I saw that in the record, and I'm not sure why that matters.
Because
why does it matter if they contest it? You have a contract that says, an bailment agreement that says you're supposed to hold this. There was never any kind of addendum, and other than there's testimony that says they had the right to sell it.
The important part is that there's only two parties to that contract, which is Sunray Marketing and Petro. Terminal is not a party to the contract. Jane Helm individually, Jeff Kirby individually.
Remind me who Kehoe is.
David Kehoe is the manager of Petro Source LLC. They are the plaintiff. Okay. So that contract, when you see it attached to the motion for summary judgment, shows very clearly, spells out, David Kehoe is the manager of PetroSource LLC. Jeff Kirby is the manager of Sunray Marketing LLC, the end. Marketing and Petro are the only parties to that contract.
And Kehoe is also, isn't he the one who testified as to the value of the...
He did, and that's, and so let's go, if we could, let's go back to that.
Before we go there, don't forget where the Justice DeHinino was. But in your response to the plaintiff's for motion summary judgment, the heart of that, as I read it, was that as to whether defendant Jeff Kirby had notified the plaintiff's manager, David C. Kehoe, that Sunray Marketing intended to withdraw plaintiff's oil from the storage and to sell it to the third party. And my question again is, why would this fact issue matter under the breach of contract case as to Sunray Marketing or any of the other parties?
Well, as to the contract with Sunray Marketing, I understand that oral consent is not enough to move the oil under that contract. So that's that. So we set that over here. As to the people who were not people and entities who were not parties to that contract, the causes of action against them are all torts. All of those torts include as an element some sort of a consent, lack of consent. You know, we've got theft, breach of fiduciary duty, conversion, unjust enrichment. All of them would require a showing that these other parties took some action that was not agreed to, not consented to, what have you, wasn't acquiesced to, for lack of a better word, PetroSource. And okay. So the evidence very clearly shows it is a 100% he said on consent. I mean, 100%.
So that matters only because the claims against the non-contractual parties have to happen.
Right.
Becomes an issue.
Right. There are a lot of different things that are wrong here, but I'll tell you what, you don't have to even get into that if we go back to what Justice Tiarina mentioned on damages. That is the really big target in this case, is the damages. This is what Kehoe said in his declaration. On February 10th, 2021, South Texas light sweet crude oil had a fair market value of $54.98 per barrel on the open market, which was the prevailing price per barrel for this grade of oil. Therefore, plaintiff's oil had a fair market value of $3,298,800 on February 10th, 2021. That's all he said.
And you believe that's a conclusory statement that can't be taken into account?
100%, absolutely. Where did that number come from? There's nothing attached to his declaration. He doesn't explain where he got it. Petro says
in his affidavit, doesn't he say that he's been in the industry and that he follows the price and he checked the price and that was what it was on that day?
But how do any of us know that's really what the price is? There's no, he didn't substantiate his
testimony. That's why you get to do, I mean, just because you get to contest it doesn't make it conclusory statement. It's no different than, in my head, I'm thinking in many of these cases where we do have default judgments on homes and the person comes in and says, this is a fair market value of the home. I mean, they don't have to do a whole analysis as long as Justice DeHinino says, he has the proper predicate laid beforehand. Isn't that testimony sufficient?
No.
Okay.
No. Because you're kind of talking
about...
One
no is enough.
You're kind of talking about the property owner rule, too.
Right.
And even in the property owner rule, if you're going to come in and talk about market value, and we're using the market value concept in this case, has to be substantiated. The homeowner, the owner of the property, can't just come in and say, this is the market value X, and that's it. They have to substantiate what the market value is. And the case law is clear on that as well. We would submit, Petro has said that you have to have an expert to testify to market value of oil. Okay, so that means it's not common knowledge to a juror. It's not common knowledge to me. I have no idea what the value of oil is. So what does that mean? An expert would have to explain, what is the market? What is the market value? What is the prevailing price? How do you find that? What's the source? Is the source reliable? You know, we know what experts are supposed to testify to. You can talk about your credentials all day long, but if your opinion is just what they, as they say, ipse dixit, that is, you have not given any support to back up your opinion, it is no evidence. And we've cited a litany of Texas Supreme Court cases. This court is well aware of this concept, too. To just say this is the number without explaining where you got the number is 100% factually conclusory. And again, whether you're a fact witness, whether you're an expert witness, whether it's a summary judgment, it's a trial, it's a default judgment. And again, too, remember, Petrosource came to the trial court with a motion for summary judgment as a plaintiff and said, we are entitled to judgment. That means Petrosource was required to conclusively establish with its motion and its evidence that it could have this judgment. And we say it absolutely did not do that. If damages have not been established as we say they have not, and again, Texas Supreme Court precedent supports our position on this, the whole case has to be reversed because you can no longer have a judgment if you don't have damages. It's plaintiff's responsibility to establish its right to damages in order to get a judgment. We've already talked a little bit about the individuals and the fact that they are protected members of limited liability companies. Plaintiff Petro has said that there are deemed admissions in this case that sort of seal the deal for them. We have shown the court, and in particular with the Texas Supreme Court case of Marshall versus Vice, V-I-S-E, which we cited in both of our case in our briefs and they've cited in theirs, a party who attempts to rely on deemed admissions waives their right to rely if they either allow controverting evidence into the record or, in this case, present that controverting evidence themselves. And that is exactly what Petrosource did. They've got what they say are deemed admissions attached, but then they've also got Jeff Kirby of Sunray Marketing's testimony attached, where he directly controverts what is stated in these alleged deemed admissions. We didn't bring forward that evidence. Petro brought forward that evidence. And I want also to step back and say, when I read all the briefing in this case again, I started sort of yelling at the paper because a lot of the analysis that Petro has provided doesn't apply in this scenario. We are fundamentally attacking their motion. Most of their cases are cases where there's no attack on the plaintiff's motion. The question is, what did the non-movement do? Did they point out their own evidence? Did they point out the other side's evidence? In this case, we are stepping all the way back to the beginning and saying, Petrosource failed on submission. And again, particularly critical when they're the plaintiff and they are seeking a judgment in their favor using the summary judgment vehicle to do so, and then you get $3.5 million. The response that was filed in this case did raise a lot of the issues that we're raising in this court, so a lot of this is not new, but we are also, we could have filed no response at all. It would have been risky, but it could have been done, I suppose, and still attack the legal sufficiency of their motion for summary judgment to begin with. And that is precisely what we're doing.
So if I understand correctly, you think, let me just drop something. That the besides the contract, the testimony of, I had it all in front of me a minute ago.
Kirby?
Is it Kirby? Yeah. The testimony you have attached to their motion for summary judgment is David Kehoe, Wade Arnold, and then the testimony during the temporary injunction of Kirby and Elm. You don't believe that testimony in whole is enough to suffice what they have set out in their motion for summary judgment?
No, because Jeff Kirby directly states that there was absolutely consent. David Kehoe knew what they were doing. This is a long-running relationship between these parties. What you do have, what Petro put before the court, doesn't flesh out the entire relationship between the parties. But you can see that obviously they've been working together for a long time because Petro had advanced money to Sunray Marketing. Sunray Marketing was paying that money back. We were now left with about $1.3 million to pay, and the whole point of the bailment agreement was to, the oil that was held in the bailment agreement was basically collateral for the $1.3 million left that we had to pay. There's a lot involved here, and I was going to say that brings into question Petro whether they had conclusively even proved recoverable damages. I mean, you look at the contract, there's offsets, there's credits, there's all kinds of things here that are in Petro's own record. And I'm out, but the last thing I want to say is they've really taken a heavy hand on this and sort of beat us over the head and treated us like that, you know, we're supposed to be death penalty sanctioned and all these sorts of things. The record doesn't support any of that, and it's a summary judgment. We're only here on a summary judgment.
I understand that. We understand that.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Smithy. I'm here on behalf of the Appalee Petrosource Partners, LLC. And we do thank y'all for taking the time to have oral argument on this case. At the outset, I do want to bring back some focus to the unchallenged facts, even on appeal, that there's no dispute on. There is no dispute that Petrosource had 60,000 barrels of oil, and there's no dispute that the Sunray Group took that oil, and even though Petrosource has demanded the return of it, it's never been returned. There's nothing in the records showing that they gave consent to them just taking this oil. There was never a gift of this oil, and nothing to suggest that they gave away their right to demand the return of it.
However, she is making the on behalf of her client, is making the argument that consent, which is one of the issues under theft conversion, unjust enrichment, that your party knew about it, and I guess there's an implied consent to that. So we know that you don't have the oil. I agree. There's supposed to be 60,000. It's yours. You don't have 60,000 oil.
Yes.
Yes. We all fully understand that. But there's more to it to prove your case than just those facts.
Well, and I think so. That's important on conversion or with theft. It's well settled that a party can initially have possession of properties or items lawfully. And so even if you were to assume, even if the court were to set aside the deemed admissions and not consider those, all that you have in the evidence is that he testified at the injunction hearing, Kirby, he testified that, well, David Kehoe knew I was moving the oil around, and so I had his implied consent. But that does not refute the fact that Kehoe then demanded the return of that oil and that they refused to ever give it back. And so even if you were to accept that there was this implied consent for some time where he was moving the oil around, that doesn't create a fact issue on the ultimate. That's part of the elements for conversion, is you make a demand for the return, and then they refuse to return it. That's when there was theft and there was conversion in this case. And of course, we would dispute that they can even raise that point, that there was this implied consent because of the deemed admissions. And that brings me, I think the court, I know it's a summary judgment proceeding, but the case law holds whenever there are these deemed admissions that are being relied on, that you also have to take into account, or should take into account, the conduct leading up to the summary judgment and whether or not there was a disregard of the rules or some bad faith in the case. And a case we cited on that point it's called Viesca versus Andrews, and it's a case where even on appeal, the defendant, there were deemed admissions, and on appeal, he was not raising an argument that they should have been withdrawn. And that's what they've done here. They have not challenged the trial court's denial of their attempt post-judgment to withdraw the admissions. They never tried to do that before judgment was entered. And in Viesca, it says, even though they're not raising that point on appeal, we still need to go and look and consider whether or not they could have ever withdrawn the deemed admissions.
Do you need the request for admissions, though? As I read through your record and your, as I just listed everything that provided in your, do you really need the request for admissions? Because the baby of deemed admissions drive me nuts. I'll just tell you right now.
And I understand. And I understand that. And I do think that the court can still affirm the summary judgment without the deemed admissions. I think the record establishes that there was a demand up until the summary judgment was filed. Kehoe even says that. He says, up until the day of this affidavit or declaration, I've made a demand for the return of the oil, and they've refused to return it. And there's so even without the deemed admissions, I still think the evidence supports all the elements of the claims here. And that's the case. Petrosource is now left without 60,000. They have nothing to show for it. It's not as if they did anything wrong here or deserve to have their oil taken away and not get anything back. And so I do think it can be affirmed without the deemed admissions. But I do think the deemed admissions, they eliminate any of this argument that there was this implied consent. And I do think that they were appropriate for use here in this case, given the conduct that occurred.
Can we accept some deemed admissions, but not all of them? I mean, when it comes to the consent issue, but not to some other aspect of what is in those deemed admissions? I didn't look at them. I don't like them, so I didn't look at them.
No, well, there's several, and some.
I don't like granting the summary judgments on deemed admissions. I'm for the record, it's clear. I think I've even said it in opinions before. With that being said, if they're there, so you know, the easiest part for this court to do is can we affirm without getting into deemed admissions? Because as you know, even the Texas Supreme Court does not like the granting of summary judgment on deemed admissions only.
Yes. So I think there are some admissions that just I don't think play a part in here. There's some that cover an issue that might not be go directly to the consent. But I do think, yes, the court could affirm on all the elements because there's the only challenge here, I believe, the main fact issue is whether or not there was this consent or implied consent. And there's nothing in the record showing that they ever, there was any consent after a demand was made for the return of the oil, that they consented to them just not returning it. And so it can be affirmed based off, and that's important. This isn't a case where it was solely a summary judgment on deemed admissions. You know, there's some cases like that where all they have in their evidence is the deemed admissions. They don't have contracts or a declaration. And that's not the case here. And some of the courts have noted that in cases when there are deemed admissions, they also look at whether or not there was other evidence supporting liability and the damages in the case. And so that is what happened here. There is enough in the record beyond the deemed admissions to show that there was liability.
Okay, so let's get past liabilities and get into the damages aspect of the case. She says that Kehoe, that in order to prove damages, you need an expert, and that expert not only must give the background and from his credentials to attest as an expert, but has to show the analysis of that, and you failed to do so in Kehoe's affidavit.
Well, on that, on the valuation testimony by Kehoe, when you look at what they're really objecting to is the reliability or the credibility of his opinion. They're not, when you go through the argument, they're not really attacking it as conclusive. They're saying he just didn't provide his backup data, so how do we know we can trust that? And whenever that's the case, the Supreme Court has said, if you're objecting to the foundational data for an opinion, you have to make that objection. And here there were no objections to his declaration in the trial court. And to the extent, I think they've tried to argue that they did object, and I don't see it in the record, but to the extent they did, they waived any of those objections by not even asking for a ruling from the trial court. And so I do think...
Well, but that's not where she's coming at. You have a summary judgment that you have to substantiate. You have a 3.3 judgment. And you have to have evidence in front of whether it could have been a default judgment. And you still have to have credible evidence in front of the trial court to substantiate $3.3 million. So whether the party objected or waived that objector, does Kehoe's testimony standing alone sufficient to substantiate $3.3 million judgment that you got?
Yes, Your Honor. It's not conclusory.
Okay.
It's not insufficient as a matter of law. And that's the only way it would...
Support
the judge. It goes in there, and when she read off what he said in his declaration, she did leave off the part where he explains that he's familiar. He keeps track of this market value of this oil on a daily basis. And this court has said in the past that he is also, it's important to note, he's also the property owner here. And when you're testifying about the value of your own personal property, this court has said that the rules regarding the testimony of that value are to be liberally construed. Not strictly, liberally construed. And they've also, the Supreme Court and other courts have said that when you're the property owner and you're testifying about the value of your own property, it's sufficient if you provide testimony showing that you're familiar with the market value. And then you base your valuation off that market value. And so here he went through and he explained, could he have provided additional documentation? I think an expert can always do that. They can always try to provide additional data to support their opinion and show it's more reliable to the judge or the jury if it was a trial. But that goes to a complaint about the reliability of the opinion, not to whether or not it's conclusory. And I think there's several cases that go into that difference, the difference between an objection for being conclusory and for reliability. And I think that's a key distinction here, is what the real complaint is that we just don't know if we can trust it, but because we don't have the foundational data. And the court has said, when you're objecting to a lack of foundational data, you have to bring that up and to the trial court's attention. And the reason for that is because you need to be able to, if there's an error like that, it's something that you're supposed to be able to fix in the trial court. And so if you don't bring that up until after post-judgment, it's just too late to do that. And so his declaration, it is enough as a matter of law to support the judgment. And so we would just ask that the court look at that declaration and also the case law. It would be a reach to say that that is conclusory on its own.
Okay.
I think going back on the deemed admissions, I know the court, whether or not it can rule in favor of Petrosaurus without them.
Before you going back to that, let me ask you a question. How do we get Kirby and Helm individually responsible on this record? That's what I was trying to figure out.
Well, so Kirby and Helm, Petrosaurus has not tried to pierce the corporate veil, and that was their argument, was that there's nothing supporting a piercing of the corporate veil. And that's not what Petrosaurus was trying to do here. Instead, they can be held liable for their own tortious conduct. And here the record establishes that it's for each defendant that they are the ones that took the oil and sold it to a third party and have refused to return.
Okay, I can see that under theft, but how do we have a breach of fiduciary duty?
On the fiduciary duty, and I think we recognize the stronger causes of actions are the conversion, theft, and unjust enrichment. And of course, on breach of contract, they have, in the response, they agree that there's liability for that. But for breach of fiduciary duty, I think it comes down to whether or not the court finds that there, as a matter of law, whether or not there was a fiduciary duty there. And the reason there would be here is, as she said, there was a long relationship there of trust between the parties. And there was this bailment agreement where they were entrusting the 60,000 barrels of oil with all the defendants. I know the contract was with Sunray Marketing.
But in order to prove conversion and or theft, they have to show that they had the oil. And I thought the oil was in Sunray's terminals possession.
Yes, so it was Sunray Marketing was who sold the oil and then was supposed to do the bailment agreement, but the Sunray Terminals who controlled the tank. Although I think the record would show that they all had control and maintained the oil or had possession of it.
Yeah, but I don't. I am trying to, as they wear their different hats, because we know they worked for the companies, but as an individual, which is how you have sued them, how do they individually have possession of the oil, which would then cause them to either be theft or have a conversion? Not in their capacity as whatever capacity they have with Sunray Terminal, but then themselves.
Well, I don't know if they necessarily, I don't think they necessarily have to have individual possession of the oil. I don't know if that's an element of the conversion claim. I think the right to possession has to belong to the plaintiff, the owner of the oil, and then you have to show that the defendant deprived them of it. And here, even though they're an officer, it's well settled that an officer of a company can be liable for their own tortious conduct, and particularly conversion, when they're the ones behind the actor behind the conversion.
So the elements in the conversion and the breach of contract are different, and I'm trying to, in my mind, deconflict the two, because if you're trying to separate the parties as individuals in the tort claims and as part of the members of the Sunray Marketing and Sunray Terminal, if on the one hand you're saying they stole it, then how could Sunray Marketing be liable for breach of contract?
Yes, so on the breach of contract, the reason it's not just a mere breach of contract is it's not as if they just lost the oil through some error with the tank where they didn't protect it and it leaked out and they lost the oil. That would probably have been just breach of contract if that happened. The reason you have a breach of contract here is because part of it was that they had not, part of their agreement was they would pay for the loss of any oil. And so that's part of that. And it's also that they didn't keep it insured. That was another requirement of that contract, was for them to keep insurance for any loss, and they admitted they didn't keep that insurance. And so that's why, I hope I'm explaining it all, the reason there goes something more beyond that for the individuals is because there was this intentional conduct where they took the oil and removed it. It wasn't by some mistake or neglect. It was all, they decided to take it out and sell it for reasons we don't know, but that's what happened. And that's why it's not just a breach of contract. And there's also tort claims in there. And I think in our briefing, we've cited some cases, even from this court, where it was a corporate officer and they tried to raise this argument where you haven't breached the, or pierced the corporate veil.
Yeah, and well, that's my concern is that you're, and that was my understanding in the briefs that you weren't attempting to pierce the corporate veil and treating all four parties as different entities, you know, individual persons and then the corporations. And so if you say one is, on the other hand, is stealing, then how could the other one be, or Sunray Marketing, breach of contract? If, I mean, and I know they're all close together, everyone knows each other, and they've been working together for a long time, but on the one hand, you're trying to separate them, but then you have to look at them together as well.
Yes, and on that issue, the only way I can say it, I think, is that there are different reasons why Sunray Marketing treated differently for its contract because of the insurance requirement and because of the requirement to pay. But yes, they were all working together. They all did it individually is what the evidence, the record shows, is that each of them admitted to taking the oil without consent, without authority. And so each of them have said that, yes, we took that oil and we sold it and we haven't returned it. And that's what Kehoe's declaration says. He says for each defendant, and he doesn't just single one out that took the oil.
What does Kirby and Helm say in their injunction? I didn't read the whole testimony. What were they thinking when they were selling this oil?
I don't think it really talks about the reasoning for why they were selling the oil.
But they did admit that it was sold.
They've admitted it was sold. I know we don't like the admissions, but I know it's in the admissions that they admit that. I'm trying to remember if there's an admission about selling it. My recollection is most of his... the problem with that hearing, it was a Zoom hearing, and there were problems with the hearing where they were going in and out, there were voices, and so if you read through it, you can see there was some confusion on what's even being talked about at times. And in that, he really what his testimony, which is relevant here, is he talks about, well, yeah, I was moving the oil, but Kehoe, Petrosource's owner, he knew it was being taken in and out. So, you know, it was okay because he knew I was moving oil around. And that's, I don't think he ever explains the reasoning behind okay. why that happened. I understand they are all being sued individually or in their separate capacities, but the reason why the individuals can be sued on that is because the record shows that they've admitted to taking and selling that oil in their individual capacity. They've made that admission and have done that. And I think Kirby, even testimony at that hearing, injunction hearing, I think at the end, I think he doesn't deny that, yeah, I owe money for this. I think that's near the end of his testimony in there is where he says, I don't really deny owing money for this. And even after that hearing, and this is in the record, there's some correspondence between that was sent from trial counsel to Sunray Group was where he had called and reached out to Petrosource's owner, Kehoe, and had said, I'm going to get this resolved, and we just never heard anything from him. And so I think he's acknowledged, the record acknowledges that he knows he owes something here in this. I think the final issue that hasn't been addressed yet, and it's not as big as the other ones, is the attorney's fees issue. And on that point, I would just say is that those arguments have already been waived. If you want to object to lack of segregation of attorney's fees, you need to do that before judgment's entered. And it's too late to try to raise that on appeal. And so we would also ask that the attorney's fee award be affirmed as well. And I will just note that when the court goes through the record and looks at Kirby's testimony from that injunction hearing, I do think, speaking of just conclusory statements or speculation, which is never competent summary judgment evidence, I think that's an important thing to look at. When Kirby's speculating about what Kehoe knows, That's just speculative, and that's never competent summary judgment evidence, and so that's not something that
I agree. But does it raise a fact issue? That's the big question. Doesn't conclusory establish that you don't win? So if they had filed a summary judgment that under the argument of affirmative defense consent, then definitely that wouldn't have been sufficient. The question is, does it raise a fact issue? Only as in my, as I read the elements, as to theft. And so that's kind of where it, you know, there are different, we like to group them together, but they're not together, right? There are four individuals with four different parties with four standings, and we have five different causes of actions.
Yes.
And so we have to go each one to each defendant, and that's what I was attempting to do. I was trying, okay, we've got a contract, but the contract's only to here. We have these other causes of actions. Okay, I can see them, you know, conversion and theft to, you know, as you're going through the analysis of the terminal, but then I get to these individuals, and then I'm trying to see how they fit into the puzzle. And so it's more complicated than a simple summary judgment.
And it is, and it's also complicated by the fact that Sunray Marketing, they didn't file a response to the summary judgment, and then you have the other defendants who filed theirs, and so I do, and you have a Sunray Marketing agreeing they're liable for breach of contract. So I know that throws in you do have to look at each cause of action separately, and I do think that's important, like you said, on the conversion and the theft, and for the unjust enrichment. But thank you for your time.
Of course.
May it please the court. The court cannot affirm this motion for summary judgment, first and foremost, because of the damages problem. There is a gaping hole in the evidence to support damages in this case.
You know, I really hate when you tell me I can't do something, Ms. Victor, or when the court can't. I understand the problem that you have with the affidavit on whether it's conclusory or not conclusory. Mm-hmm. I understand that on its face it is easy to state that the affidavit does make a conclusory statement. I will agree with you. The question is there enough meat around it that this court can take it into account?
When you read the Texas Supreme Court authority on this issue, you can see that the qualifications of the witness testifying and then the opinion that the witness states are two entirely different things. You can be qualified till you're blue in the face, but when it comes to what your opinion is, you've still got to substantiate it. Just because you're an expert doesn't mean that the opinion that you say is true. That's ipse dixit.
But if he can testify as simple as, I'm in the business, I know the price of oil, the price of oil was this on this date, I'm taking that number and multiplying it by 6,000, and that's how I get to the value of this crude oil.
How do we know that's the number on that date? He doesn't show us where he got the number. He could have attached something. He could have attached something that shows whatever fair market value is, whatever prevailing price is. He can't just come in and spout off a number. He's got to support that.
Later in the affidavit say that on another date it was this amount, which would have made our damages even more on another date?
He does say that, but we've still got the same problem.
So are you saying that he's required to attach some self-authenticating document, and maybe something from a journal or something, like in the old days where it had to be print, and stick it to the back of it?
Absolutely, because otherwise this is truly factually conclusory, and factually conclusory is a well-honored phrase that means no evidence. You can be legally conclusory because you gave some legal opinion that's not supported, or opinion on the law. You can be factually conclusory because you gave an opinion on a fact and there's no evidence to back it up. So we say that one sole sentence in that affidavit will not support a $3.3 million judgment in this case. Regarding the deemed admissions, those deemed admissions, again, have been waived. There's no question they've been waived. By the way, when you see them, most of them have to do with the bailment agreement and the purchase agreement. There's very few that have anything to do with liability on the torts. There's nothing in there that takes the protections away from Kirby and Helm, and there's nothing in there about damages. You know, the only thing we've got on damages is Kehoe's one sentence in his affidavit. Regarding the various causes of action, in their brief, it looks like they've sort of jettisoned breach of fiduciary duty. They just talk about it sort of in a little footnote. They don't say anything about terminal in their brief. Their cases regarding members of limited liability companies are not actually LLC cases, they're corporate officer cases. Limited liability companies exist for a reason, to protect the members.
But if we're individual corporate officers, employees can be individually responsible for their own tort actions, i.e. assault, theft.
Oh, sure.
You know, so there could be a sense of that they can individually stand on their own cause of actions, even if they are an LLC.
There is no evidence that these people acted, they didn't go rogue and act individually.
Right.
They're actually really, there's no evidence Jane Helm took any action with respect to this oil at all. I mean, Jane's on her own island. You know, I mean, Jane is definitely on her own island. And Jeff Kirby, throughout this record, whether it's Petro's pleadings, the evidence, what have you, shows he is at all times a manager of Sunray Marketing LLC. There is nothing in this record, deemed admission or otherwise, that shows that Jeff Kirby went rogue. When you read the temporary injunction stuff, you will see there's obviously, it's true that Jeff Kirby doesn't explain why this oil is moving around, but the way he talks about it, it's like this is their method of doing business. I'm not in oil and gas sales. I don't know how this stuff works, but it sounds like this is the nature of the business, and Jeff Kirby and David Kehoe were doing this together with their LLCs. Because Jeff Kirby is very matter-of-fact about it. Yeah, we were moving oil, but also we're bringing it back. He said on a daily basis we're putting oil into that tank. So I do take issue with the idea that the oil's gone, it will always be gone, it's never coming back. Jeff Kirby was very clear that on a daily basis oil's coming in and going out of the tank. There's two other things I want to mention quickly. One is the injunction that protected 22,000 barrels of oil for Petro's benefit. We've raised that in our briefing. Shouldn't that be accounted for? Even if you decide that Kehoe's testimony is okay, Petro still hasn't shown recoverable damages in this case. They haven't shown $3.3 million in recoverable damages. You got 22,000 barrels that were held in protection. Then you've also got in this record a Rule 11 and notice to the court about 48,000 barrels of oil that the parties agreed belonged to a third party would be released to that third party, and Petro was getting cash under an agreement with Sunray. That never came, you know. Petro says, oh, well, the court should take judicial notice of everything in its file before it decides a summary judgment. Then the court should have taken judicial notice of an agreement for a value of 48,000 barrels that was going to Petro. There's so many things that are wrong with this case. It's really unfortunate how it came to the end result that it did. We're asking for legal and equitable relief, so we have a chance to do this again. We've got to get the parties out who shouldn't be here, get the claims out that shouldn't be here, and get this damage thing figured out.
Okay, so with that being said, have these parties mediated this case?
No.
No?
No.
Would it help y'all if this court ordered it to mediation before we make decisions that neither of you are going to like at the end of the day?
Can we have a chance to chat with clients about it and then inform the court in the next couple of days?
Yes.
Is that suitable?
Would that be okay, Ms. Smithy?
Yes, I'll have to check with the clients.
Please, check with your clients. I don't need a decision from you right now. That's
okay.
No, but
thank you.
If you would both check with your clients due to the longstanding relationship of these parties, I think it might be beneficial. This panel thinks it would be beneficial for y'all to proceed maybe. But let us know.
Message received.
If not,
thank you. Thank you for your time. Have a good day.
Thank you.